Imagine a platform where some of Britain's biggest stars have the opportunity to reflect and celebrate their biggest professional accomplishments in a lovely, relaxed, chatty space. Since 2016, Josh Barry's Beyond the Title has celebrated the great and good of entertainment, from showbiz legends to rising stars and everyone in between, who have each provided an insight into their remarkable careers in the public eye. So join Josh and the team as another significant figure in entertainment shares their unique anecdotes and stories exclusively on Beyond the Title.
Radio and television personality Greg James joined BBC Radio 1 in 2007 as the host of The Early Breakfast Show before replacing the great Edith Bowman on weekday afternoons in 2009. He remained there for 3 years until a scheduling reshuffle resulted in him securing the drive time slot. In 2017, he became the host of the 5 Live cricketing podcast Tail Enders, alongside Felix White, Jimmy Anderson and producer Mark Sharman. This was then followed by another BBC Sounds podcast, Teach Me a Lesson, alongside his wife Bella. In 2009, he presented a TV show for BBC Three called Sun, Sex and Holiday Madness, about British tourists in Magaluf and young, jobless and living at home, also for BBC Three. An unlikely union with the writer and comedian Russell Kane in 2012 resulted in the BBC Three entertainment series Britain Unzipped, followed by the short and chat show version Unzipped. Yet on the 20th of August 2018, James inherited one of the most coveted roles in daytime radio when he replaced Nick Grimshaw for the BBC Radio 1 breakfast show. I caught up with one of the leading figures in broadcasting to talk sport, music and his recollections on an exciting career in the public eye. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Greg James.
Great.
Okay. Well, welcome to Beyond the Title. You're one of the biggest figures in daytime radio, but what sort of relationship did you have with radio growing up? Is it true that you had a hilarious experience with hospital radio?
Well, hi, Josh, first of all. Thanks for having me on Beyond the Title. Very, very happy to be here and to nerd out about radio stuff, because I know you're a big radio nerd as well. Yes, my life really has been accompanied by the radio. When I was a kid, I remember vividly that I started really getting into radio when my mum used to take me to school, and there was a slight issue with basically my mum and dad were both teachers, so they, when they got new jobs, they couldn't leave straight away, and therefore I couldn't leave my school and all the rest of it. So there was a situation where I was about 9 or 10, where we were driving about 2 hours each way to school around the motorway, around the M25, but that meant I could listen to a lot of radio, and I listened to a lot of breakfast shows with my mum. And I remember vividly getting so into the Russ and Jono breakfast show on Virgin Radio back in the old days, and that really started my obsession with it, to be honest. And then I just thought, this is such a magical thing. I love that we're all part of this gang, and that's what I think is so special about radio, and that's what I hope to achieve with my shows, is that you want everyone to feel like they're part of a gang or a team, and everyone's got a say, and everyone can chip in and say a funny thing when they've got a funny thing to say, or they send me an email with a funny video. So I love that sort of community aspect of it. And yeah, what you're getting at is, on hospital radio, when I was about 15, 16, I went and helped out at my local hospital radio station in Bishop Stortford, called Radio Stortford. And I learned so much from the team there. They sort of showed me how to use the desk. They taught me through how to make jingles and play the jingles and stuff. And I broadcast a couple of shows, or I thought I did, but it turned out that the antenna, the aerial wasn't working, and it wasn't transmitting at all. So I was doing a show to nobody. But actually, that's quite a nice lesson, in that you've got to do a show for however many people are listening, whether it's 1 million or maybe zero, it's still just as special. So I really look back very fondly about of those memories.
Yeah. So up to today, you're no stranger to the podcast format. In fact, you not only present one podcast, but two. You've just been on tour with the BBC sports podcast Tail Enders. In your opinion, do you see the live circuit being the future of the podcast format? And who's been your favourite guest?
It's a great question. I think it's a really lovely addition to podcasting, because, you know, much like following a band or an artist, you have people who are sort of mega fans. So I think I think, yes, that will be a big part of podcasting as things go on. But I do think it's super serving the people that listen to every episode and love every word of it, which is so brilliant. But I do think you need to remember to keep it broad and keep finding new audiences and not just, you know, do the same thing for the same people over and over again. But it's been a lovely sort of celebration of it. And I've loved doing the live stuff. We did a show at Hammersmith Apollo recently where we got Stuart Broad on as a special guest. So for those who don't know, Stuart Broad and Jimmy Anderson are two of England's greatest ever bowlers. Stuart Broad retired this year, and those two bowled in like a really beautiful partnership for years. And we got Stuart Broad on as a special guest. So to have him with Jimmy talking about the old days and just talking about those final matches together was really something very special. And the roar, I've never heard a crowd like it. We were at the Hammersmith Apollo, and there was about 3,000 people there, and I've never heard such a noise when Stuart Broad walked out. So yeah, it's really nice to have that as a celebration of the podcast. But I think audio and radio in all its forms will never really go away. It finds ways to reinvent itself all the time.
But we keep really so much.
Josh, we tried to do a couple of live shows with you on the side. One we did at the Museum of Comedy, which was fine. It's nice and small, we tried to do another one and it just didn't sell. I suppose it's hard to just get people. It's hard to get the right person as well. Like you say, I think it makes a difference with the guest. It's difficult. But we, you know, probably just because we were at the cutting edge, you know, we tried to do that a couple of years ago. So that's all.
It's a tricky one. And we found with Tailenders it was hard in certain places. Time of the week, time of the year, where it falls around payday. There's a cost of living crisis, and people are going out less, and people tend to pick one thing, or they can't travel because the costs are too high. So there's a lot of things, a lot of difficulties at the minute with doing live anything, and particularly live podcasts. So it's just a question of just keeping the podcast good is the main thing that we focus on, and just going like that. The live show is a sideshow almost, but the fact that the day in, day out, and week in, week out, the podcast has to be good. Otherwise, you know, what's the point of it?
And your second podcast with your wife, Bella, what was the inspiration for that? And do you think that what do you think the podcast format's able to capture, which other mediums can't?
The idea is it was called Teach Me a Lesson. And it actually was a lockdown project. When it was, you know, when everyone was sort of saying, oh, we've got a bit more time now, we can learn to play an instrument, can learn a language or whatever it might be. We were chatting one day when we were walking, thinking, there's so many things that I wish I'd done differently at school. I wish I'd concentrated more in history, or I wish I'd read that book in English and taken it seriously or whatever. So it was the jumping off point was that. And it was to say, let's get some teachers on. They will teach us their favourite lesson. It gives the teachers an amazing platform to celebrate how great they are, because, as I said, both my parents bring stuff from them. But it was a sort of an excuse to let the best place to do it, because you've got the luxury of time. You don't have, you can't do that on the radio because you've got songs to play, or you've got the news to do, or the travel or whatever. So it felt like a good place to have a long form chat with them, and it's interactive as well, and you can listen to them. They're all up on BBC Sounds now, so you can listen to an episode on the Windrush, or you can listen to an episode on we had one on spies during World War II. We had an episode that was all about like espionage and how in the war they hid bombs in rats and things. So there's like loads of fascinating things, and we thought that was a good place to put them, almost like box sets.
Okay, cool. So back to radio, you've managed to secure, and you're currently in one of the most prestigious roles in British radio. How did you feel when you secured the BBC Radio 1 breakfast show? And in your opinion, how important is the breakfast show for setting the tone for the station?
Yeah, fantastic question. It does exactly that. Any breakfast show does set the tone for the day because it's going through. There was something I read in Chris Evans's book years ago where he said that the breakfast show sets the agenda for the day and the drive time show reflects the day. But loosely, that is right and is really good. It is a really good point. And I just felt incredibly excited. It felt like, I mean, honestly, I hoped that one day I'd get a shot at being on Radio 1. And when that happened, I thought, oh my God, well, this is only going to last a year. And when I eventually got breakfast, I felt so lucky to get it that I just wanted to just run at it and embrace it and make the very most out of every single show. So it's something that I will always look back on probably with the most enormous amount of pride out of everything I will ever do. And that's okay. This was always something that I thought probably wouldn't ever happen. I still every day think, oh my God, it happened. I am actually doing this. And it feels really special every day. Obviously, you get days where you're tired or during the pandemic where you just think, how are we ever going to find anything fun here? And it's definitely a hard job. It's definitely hard. It's hard to make it sound fun sometimes. But I love it. And it does feel like a very important show to do because the rest of the station sort of follows your lead, I guess. And they look to you for guidance, I suppose, when there's sort of a big world event. So if there's a war or a royal death or a pandemic, the station has to kind of follow you. So there's an element of sort of being I guess the head boy to a certain extent. It's like, how do we deal with this stuff? And I quite like that role, it turns out. I like that role of sort of leading people into the day, I guess, and helping out newer producers and newer assistant producers and newer presenters. It's something that it's the role I never thought I'd have. But I'm really, really grateful for that thing in my professional life by a very long way.
At Radio 1, you've climbed the ranks from the classic 4 a.m. early breakfast show, mid-afternoons and drive time. In what ways did that offer you a broad insight into the way Radio 1 interacts with its audience?
I was thinking about this the other day, actually, Josh, and I was thinking about all the people that I've talked to over the last 16 years. And it's such a privilege to be in front of such a vast amount of people and also such a range of people from all over the country, all backgrounds, doing all sorts of jobs. And they're all united with one thing, which is they love the radio station, they love the music, and they love fun stuff. And it's been such an education for me in like insights into what people's jobs are like. Like, I've spoken to more truckers than I ever would have imagined. Do you know what I mean? It's like there's worlds that I've been allowed to have a look at that I never would have done before, and I've learned so much about them. It's so amazing that I've got to do that. And you learn very quickly what Radio 1 can do for your day. And I've loved being at those different parts of the day. Early breakfast, as you said, was great fun because it was wild and people were coming home from clubs pissed, or they were getting up early for night shifts, or they were, you know, getting ready for school and up early and whatever it is. And then the afternoon was completely different again. It was people in workplaces or on their lunch break or coming home, you know, going to night shifts or whatever. So it's been really interesting. Also feeling the mood of the nation over the last 15, 16 years. You can tell when people are happy or sad or worried about things. And we've gone through financial crises. We've gone through pandemics and all sorts. And it's been a real privilege to be at the sharp end of it and to actually interact with people from all over the place. I feel incredibly lucky to have been exposed to that.
Hmm. Your shows are always full of really nice, silly bits. But one of our favourite features of daytime radio was something you called Someone From One Extra. Two questions. Did you ever find out? And secondly, how did you get that feature past BBC management?
I don't know, actually. I don't know how that got past. I don't know. It was a simpler time. But it was, I think it was innocent. That was why it wasn't flagged as being aggressive or flashing. It was the fact that it was just on a little CCTV camera, because I turned away to take my trousers off. And I do know the person who saw my Winky, and her name is Julie. And I have chatted to Julie since to see if she's not traumatized by it. And I was disappointed, actually, that she said that she doesn't really have much of a recollection of it, which does tell a story on its own.
Beyond radio, in 2012, you united with a great Russell Kane for the BBC Three entertainment series Britain Unzipped. In an age when the BBC arguably struggled to create those outrageous late-night formats which are synonymous with Channel 4, how did this show attempt to create a more risque, age-appropriate atmosphere to the BBC Three audience?
Yeah, I love that show. I think it was slightly ahead of its time in certain respects, in that it was really lovely because it was about the viewers and it was about the country, and that's what drew me to it. And it was just silly, and we had a lot of fun making that. I mean, it was so fun. It was a shame that it came at a time when BBC Three, BBC was thriving at that time, actually. And then it sort of fell foul of the, we're going to put it all online type thing. And that was a mistake. And then it's sort of come back to terrestrial TV a little bit too late, arguably. But it was really fun. And I think the spirit of BBC Three is still good. Like, there's still some really fun things being commissioned. But yeah, it was always supposed to be a little bit of a bit more of an outrageous channel, and it was supposed to be for people who wanted a laugh. It wasn't necessarily just for young people. It was just for people that had a similar sense of humour and liked silly things. But yeah, I look back on those times so fondly. Me and Russell just arsing around for a couple of hours a week. It was great fun, and it did quite well, that show. It did like couple of million viewers. It was decent. They were good times.
And then earlier this year, you presented the Channel 4 reality show Rise and Fall. How was the experience of hosting a primetime TV show?
Yeah, very exciting. It was a real learning experience for everyone that worked on it, because it was a very tight turnaround and we were still messing with the format in the days leading up to the first episode. So it was good, because I'm used to that sort of quick turnaround with radio, and you suddenly, they change the idea and they go, right, no, you need to be here. This is your new role. And I quite like that. And it felt quite live, even though it wasn't live. It felt very exciting and daring, I guess. And it had big budget as well, which is really exciting. And Channel 4 really backed it, and there was big marketing behind it. And yeah, I really hope that comes back next year, because it did really well on catch up. Lots of people watched it on Channel 4 online. And it's one of those good shows that you wait till it's finished and then you binge it, a bit like The Traitors. And I loved doing that. I quite liked being a bit more severe and a bit more intimidating in my high heels and my big jackets and roll necks.
Yeah.
I've noticed that I'm actually wearing one of them today. And Josh, we're sort of wearing the same jumper today.
It's not with you. Yeah.
Yeah, it's our uniform.
Being the current doyen of Radio 1, you're following in the footsteps of some mavericks of daytime radio, going back to people like Simon Dee and Kenny Everett, and more recently Chris Evans and Chris Moyles, who each had a very complex relationship with the BBC. What lessons do you think both you and the corporation have learned from your predecessors, which may help with your longevity for the show? And in your opinion, why is the role more prestigious than the other broadcasting roles?
Yeah, that's a really fantastic question. It's I think the world has changed a lot since those days. And there's less, I think there's less room for massive ego. And I do think that's a good thing. That doesn't play to my strengths necessarily. I mean, everyone's got an ego. I wanted to host the breakfast show and I really love the fact that I do that. So I'm not saying I'm without ego, but I think what's happened is that no one's all powerful and you sort of need, you need everyone in order to make a good thing. And I've always been better working in a team of people, and to sort of make it less about me and more about the show or the listeners or the component parts of it. So that's why I think I'm doing okay in this era, because I never really wanted to be the big, brash sort of Moyles Evans character. That was actually never really massively appealed to me. I was much more into like the world that you could create. And not to say that Moyles and Evans didn't do that. They did that amazingly. But I wasn't so enamored by the zoo format, for example. I quite liked the idea of the listeners being the zoo, if you like. So in terms of that, I've always wanted to include people and make sure that it's not just about me, and that we welcome new presenters, that we welcome new artists, and we welcome new listeners, and make everyone feel like they're the star. I don't like feeling like I'm the star, if that makes sense. I like that the listeners are the star of the show. So I think that's changed slightly, in that the interaction's different. There was actually, you know, when Evans was doing the breakfast show, there wasn't that instant interaction. So you couldn't just get people on the show that quickly. It took a little bit more time and there wasn't texts flying in. So I feel like it's easier for me in that way. And in terms of the relationship with the BBC, well, I've never really had a problem with it. They've sort of, I always think the BBC is a really fun sort of headmastery, headmistressy figure to play with. So it's quite nice to sort of gently take this thing to rail against that the BBC is doing. And I'm not in the mood for falling out with people or kicking off, or I just, that's not really how I operate, and it's not something that I really was attracted to when I was a listener. I don't think people should be, I don't know, I never found it funny that people would sort of like just fall out with a radio station and start getting a bit big for their boots, because I just feel, you know, the late great Terry Wogan, sort of, I'll paraphrase him when he left. He was like, you know what, you do this for however many years. He did it for like 20, 30 years, Radio 2 Breakfast on and off. And he said, and tomorrow I'm not going to be on it and everyone will move on with their lives. I don't think of myself as that amazing that the world will end when I'm not doing radio. I guess that's it. I think I've probably got a healthy dose of of reality. Some would argue maybe a lack of confidence or ambition, I don't know. But I don't see it as something to kind of go, I'm the best ever, or how it should be. But and also, sorry, just to add, I think the world's changed and people would not tolerate that, and rightly so. They'd be like, sorry, you're paid a fortune to just do something which is really fun, sort of sort yourself out type thing. So I guess that's part of it. I probably err the other way, which is maybe being too humble about being on the breakfast show, but I'd rather it that way than the other way.
Josh, it's funny you mentioned Wogan, because it seems like when we interview anyone from the radio, it's sort of finds its way back to mentioning Wogan. Why do you think he was so important?
Well, I think he's the master of not making it about himself. And there was just this wonderful warmth and lightness with him that meant that you wanted to spend time with him, but it didn't mean that he was boring or dull or generic. He was actually quite rude at times and got away with it because he was so gentle on the surface, but he was incredibly witty. He could be incredibly cutting. I just think he was just subtle in a way that some of those other characters we mentioned weren't. And I was more drawn to him with a little nudge and a wink, as opposed to saying, this is everything that I am every day. Like, I am this, I am that. Whereas Wogan was very welcoming and he made the listeners the star. And he got on with people and was interested in people. It wasn't the Terry Wogan show. It was everyone's show that he just happened to be the ringleader of. And that's much more my sensibilities, I guess. I was drawn to that, and I was drawn to any show that would create some sort of community. But yeah, I think most conversations about music radio should come back to Terry Wogan, because he was the, you know, in sort of, he was the great. He was the great one that did it so brilliantly and will always be held as the best one to have ever done it, I think.
So now you're one of the best loved voices on radio, and with the advent of social media, it's almost become part of the role of a broadcaster to appear universally accessible. Do you ever think there'll be a time when broadcasters like you will be forced into abandoning social media? And how do you find the perfect balance between staying true to being accessible and the friendly image you've created whilst maintaining your personal privacy?
Yeah, really good. I mean, I honestly don't find it much of a stress at all. I know other people do, but I was very lucky that I'm not that old, that when I joined Radio 1, the O stuff, and to the point where I remember my boss, when I was 21 when I started, said, the good thing about you, Greg, is you're a digital native. And I went, okay, right, thanks, Grandad. But that meant that I naturally wanted to do stuff online, and I wanted to be parodies and being online. So I genuinely love all that kind of technology, and I loved Twitter when it first started. I really embraced Instagram. I've loved in the last few years getting to work out what I can do on TikTok and what that means. And I just think you do, you know, on Radio 1 in particular, especially on The Breakfast Show, you have to be aware of these things. It's no good just saying, well, that's not for me, I don't really understand TikTok. Well, a lot of the audience does, and you're not doing your job properly if you don't embrace it or at least try and understand it. You suddenly become old very quickly if you go, I don't like any of this new music. Well, look, you've got to look for some merits in all these things, and that's part of the job. You have to evolve, and you have to change your act accordingly. You have to learn from your mistakes. You have to learn from the stuff you were doing 10 years ago and say, was that good? How can I make that better? So this whole job is, you never arrive at a place in this job where you're like, I've done it. I'm the best. I'm here. I'll be better next year, hopefully, and the year after, and I'll be different 5 years from now. And that's kind of part of it. The job is not, I got the job and I smashed it. It's, I got the job and I am getting better at it, and there's longevity, and that means embracing everything. So I don't really find it stressful doing social media stuff. I find it a really great creative outlet when I'm not on the radio. I love making little videos. I love coming up with fun little bits, and that's it. And I suppose when I get tired, I just put the phone down, and that can be tricky to I have to delete the apps when I'm having a weekend to myself, but it's not a huge hardship, but it's very much part of the job. I want people to feel like they can hang out with me whenever. And a thing that I do on Instagram the night before will very much appear on the show and could be a big part of it the next day. So it all links up nicely.
In your opinion, how important are features like the 10-minute takeover engaging the ever-changing wants and desires of the Radio 1 demographic? And can you identify trends and themes in audience based on audience tastes based upon what they request?
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes back to that conversation we were having about being in front of the audience. You know, the bosses obviously know a lot about the media world, but the presenters and the producers are the ones that know the listeners best, because we're there with them every day for hours. I'm spending hours with them, talking to them on the phone, speaking about their favorite TV shows. They will text in things about certain guests we have. So yes, you can absolutely gauge what people are into and what catches on, and you can feel it. You can feel when a feature connects or a guest connects or a talking point about a TV show. You can tell when it connects. So that is, you're right, it's amazing feedback. In terms of 10-minute takeover, people love the classics. People love nostalgia and all the rest of it. So that does tend to skew a little bit more older, as in like older songs, but only in the last sort of 10, 15 years, I'd say max. And what we get with the 10-minute takeover is a reminder that even though we've got every song in the whole world at our fingertips, there's nothing quite like hearing your favorite song on the radio and hearing a request. And that's still quite nice and old school, I think. And it's really important to have those features that happen every day at the same time. Quiz at 7:15, all the latest things at 10 to 8, 10-minute takeover at 9. They're very important in breakfast radio to have those tent poles where people go, oh, it's quiz time, I should be going to the bus. Oh, it's 10-minute takeover, I should be at work by that point, or whatever it is. So they're really important in sort of routine building. And it's not an accident that they're there at the same time every day.
And
people love routine.
Well, yeah, and you're struggling with that a bit at the moment with cowboy time, aren't you? With the taking the 10 to 10 feature away from people, they're crying about it.
Right, well, that's exactly it. You know, like, people get cross if you mess with their routine. So, you've got to do that at your peril.
Yeah. As we know, youth-orientated radio is a transient role, and the breakfast show has a responsibility to reflect the station's image. It's a difficult question to ask, but how hard is it and how hard will it be to bid farewell to Radio 1, especially the breakfast show?
Yeah, it will be incredibly weird. It will be incredibly hard because I haven't known anything different for most of my adult life. And I do think about that, and I think about it deeply every now and then. Over the last few years, particularly during the pandemic, I have thought about when is the right time to walk away from it. And luckily, there have been so many brilliant, fun things that have happened that have kept me interested and kept me challenged and reminded me why I wanted to work here in the first place, and what fun there is to come. I guess I keep finding new things that excite me about it. And that's always been my test. I sort of get to the end of the year and go, do I still like this? Do they still like me? Am I still good at this? Is this something that can I give things to the radio station? Because that's important. You don't want to outstay your welcome. And the music we play, the events we put on, the callers we get, there is not anywhere else in the world, really, I don't think, with radio that has the same type of listeners, the same willingness to do fun stuff, the same, so I think about it a lot, and I love this radio station so much, and I didn't know what I'd be doing at my age now, but I'm really... I feel so happy and content doing it. And I think the age thing is less important than it used to be, because it's sort of about a mindset and a willingness to stay involved and stay on top of things that are new and current. And I still love it so much. So it's, it will be a huge, huge wrench for me to wake up one morning and not be Greg James from Radio 1. Weird thought. But it will happen.
That's changed quite a lot, hasn't it? You know, that thing of it, the movement through BBC radio, like Radio 1 to Radio 2, and like the way that Scott Mills has done it is sort of slightly different to how others would. And you've had quite a long career already at Radio 1, yeah. but Radio 1 always feels like the start of people's career rather than, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's, I think it's just, I think it varies so much. And I don't look at it's difficult to, I try not to look back too much just because it will make you go mad. but mainly because so much life happens in 16 years. Yeah. But, you know, I think people have relaxed a lot about people's ages, and that's a great thing. I mean, Radio 1 has been obsessed ever since I started with, like, when you're 30, it's time to move on. That's what? Yeah. That is mad. You know, the biggest entertainers in the world, if you look at comedians or late-night chat show hosts in America, or, you know, Ant and Dec are what, mid-40s? Like, late 40s? You know, they're relevant and they're exciting and they feel like they want to keep up with stuff. And it's yeah, you just got to stay interested, really, and that's how I feel with Radio 1. I'm interested in new stuff and exciting guests and young actors and young pop stars and artists. I don't feel in a sort of hurry to get out the door, you know.
Josh, don't worry, we're not saying you're wrong.
Thanks, Josh. correct answer. Very useful.
this is quite a deep question. What does radio mean to you?
It's been a constant friend in my life ever since I can remember. Probably my oldest friend, really. If that doesn't sound too sappy, but it's given me so much. It's introduced me to some of my favorite presenters. It's introduced me to some of my favorite songs and artists and bands. It's given me some of my actual best friends, having worked here. It connects you to the world. It connects you to people that you would never meet and you'd never hear from. Tells amazing stories. It's sort of it's my greatest friend, I guess. And it's a complete privilege to be part of its history. I think that would be the thing I'll be most proud of. I think it's a really lovely question, and I've never really been asked that before, but it's something I think about privately. Obviously, I don't talk about it that much because it's very personal. But it's the most wonderful, magical medium that can take you all over the world without having to leave your seat.
Yeah.
So you've touched on it a couple of times, but looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
Getting the breakfast show, really. And that first morning, I'll never get over it. My memory of it was so vivid. I can remember how I felt. I can remember what I was wearing. I can remember what everyone's faces were doing as I was about to put the mic up for the first time. And I'll never forget it. It was, I think I'd never felt more myself, probably. And that's quite a special thing to feel. You feel totally at home. And yeah, I probably feel most comfortable in a radio studio, actually.
Yeah. So last question, what's next for Greg James?
Well, I need a wee, so I'm going to go for a wee. I've had quite a busy morning. Quite a busy morning. I'm sorry that was not the answer you were looking for, but I felt like I took it too deep, so I needed to break the intensity. what's next? Well, I'm just honestly really content with all the things that I'm doing at the minute. So I want to make sure I focus on them and enjoy them, the future, and go on. Yeah, but what's next? But what's next? But what's next? And that will come. And there's those discussions are important, and you know all the rest of it. But just really happy to be on Radio One for, you know, at least the next couple of years. I'm just about to re-sign for another couple of years on Breakfast, which I feel really excited about. And then I'm still writing my children's book, so we're doing some really exciting stuff in the new year with that. Tailenders is still rolling on. And I've been really enjoying doing some TV stuff. So when the right TV thing comes along, I'll do that if I've got time to do it. And that's a very lucky position to be in. But you know what? I'm very happy with where I've got to. And I don't crave to be more famous. I don't crave to be richer. Do you know what I mean? I judge things when they come along, and if they feel right, I'll jump at them. But I don't sit here thinking, I need a bigger radio show, or I need a bigger TV platform, or I need to go to America, or I don't feel those urges. I just feel very, very content in my life. And I want to make sure that I do and also enjoy my life. I think that's important. I've worked really hard over the last 15 years or so to sort of get a good career. And I sort of want to, I don't want to say take my foot off the gas, but I do want to have a bit more life and have a bit more time to enjoy my friends and particularly my family, my mum and dad, and you know, while they're still around, I guess. So yeah, not neglecting my actual life, I suppose, is where I want to, what I want to do next.
Thank you very much to our wonderful guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title episode. If you like this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else you like? We're now on Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, Apple Music, and Amazon Music. Everywhere, quite frankly. Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews, and please do give this podcast a little share. Not in a shoop-shoop song kind of way, you understand, although that's probably quite welcome. Thanks again. Hopefully see you next time. From all of us here, goodbye.